Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have details on a fire that threatened homes in Rancho San Diego, Spring Valley, and La Mesa on Friday. Also hear about a meeting coming up Tuesday night with neighbors of Gillespie Field and an attorney regarding a class action lawsuit about to be filed over airport noise and expansion. Learn about a new cross-border agreement to help reduce tuberculosis cases in our region and improve treatment. On Green Scene, hear about the costs of environmental hazards in our state. We'll also have details on a new phone scam targeting the elderly in our county. And from Public News Service, hear about protests over private prisons in California. Our newsmaker interview today is with Tony Tiora, a past candidate for Assembly who will be making a very special announcement on our show today. Later, we'll take you on the road to Acumba Hot Springs, a town bubbling with change. Hear about the Senior Gleaners program to help feed the hungry in our region and what you can do to help. Plus, we'll have some good news for people who enjoy camping at Lake Jennings, and with those sizzling hot summer days now here, we'll have some tips for you to keep your pets safe and cool. So stay tuned for these stories and more on today's East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. That was the sound of emergency vehicles responding to the scene of a fire that started near the junction of Highway 94 and Hamishaw Boulevard Friday afternoon. The blaze sparked the sheriff to advise residents of voluntary evacuations and raise concerns among residents in Spring Valley, Rancho San Diego, and La Mesa. Numerous witnesses told East County Magazine that they heard up to a dozen explosions before fire crews arrived on the scene. Local businessman Michael Anderson said he heard a large explosion followed by several smaller ones. It was getting pretty scary, he said. Thick smoke covered the neighborhood and traffic was shut down briefly on Highway 94 before firefighters from CAL FIRE, the County Fire Department, and San Miguel Fire contained the blaze in the evening with help from aerial drops. The blaze caused some damage to an SDG&E substation, though power to the 20,000 homes it serves was not interrupted. After the fire was knocked down with multiple water drops, an all-female San Diego County Jail inmate crew was brought in to quench the fire on the ground. While local residents were not subject to a mandatory evacuation, a temporary shelter was established at Monta Vista High School. The fire that burned 10 to 15 acres started in a canyon where there are homeless encampments. A man and a woman seen leaving the encampment area have been detained for questioning, though as of our taping deadline, no charges had been filed. The sheriff's bomb and arson unit is investigating. One local resident, Diana Reed, told us she was upset she couldn't reach her elderly mother who lived above the fire. Reed was at the Del Mar Fair when she heard about the blaze and rushed back to the area but could not get in to reach her mom because the streets were blocked to protect public safety. She called 911 to report that her mother was home alone and was advised by the sheriff's office that fortunately fire crews on the scene were made aware of the situation. That incident serves as an important reminder. Sign up for Sheriff Nixle alerts for your own zip code as well as zip codes of family members in our region so that you will be notified if an evacuation is actually imminent or ordered. We also recommend signing up for East County Magazine's Wildfire and Emergency Alerts, which cover regional emergencies such as brush fires, severe weather alerts, and major traffic hazards. You can sign up to get our alerts via email at eastcountymagazine.org or get our alerts as text messages on your cell phone by following East County Alert on Twitter. We don't wait until a major fire forces evacuations in your neighborhood to get your alerts out for major regional threats because we know that the sooner you are aware, the sooner you can prepare and help keep you and your family safe. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Dozens of families are close to filing a lawsuit over the increased air traffic at Gillespie Field Airport, where more expansion is planned. But with a June 30th deadline to file paperwork with a class action lawyer, another 24 residents are needed to join the suit. Sue Strom with Advocates for Safe Airport Policies, or ASAP, says this is our last chance to get something done. A meeting is set for Tuesday, June 23rd at 6:30 p.m. with the lead attorney and interested residents. The meeting will be held at a private home in Fletcher Hills. To RSVP and get directions, contact asapgillespiefield.com. Residents have complained about a recent increase in flight schools and potential hazards ranging from lead pollution to crashes over residential neighborhoods. Several mishaps have already occurred, including one small plane that crashed onto the driveway of a home. Gillespie is now defined by the Federal Aviation Administration as a national airport. That means funding is expected for expansion of runways and yet another increase in flight schools to serve the international demand for more pilots. Strom says, "We have a training pattern running through the heart of our neighborhoods, and that training pattern will become even busier than it is unless we take a stand for our community now. We are already sitting under 140 to 190 touch-and-go operations every single day." The county has disputed claims such as frequent and low-flying aircraft over homes, health and safety risks. But residents say that they've had noise and real estate experts out to their neighborhoods in the past several months who have documented the situation. The attorneys retained by residents are from East County and have dealt with flight schools before, according to Strom. The June 23rd meeting will provide an opportunity for residents to get questions answered and help get a class action lawsuit filed to take action. For more information on the residents' complaints about Gillespie Field, you can visit asapgillespiefield.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. A binational agreement to combat tuberculosis on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border was signed on Friday. This partnership builds on ongoing efforts between San Diego and Imperial Counties and the state of Baja California, Mexico. The newly signed pact aims to assure that all TB patients receive treatment and to enhance investigations of possible exposures. In the last 2 decades, the annual number of TB cases in San Diego County has been cut by more than 50%, thanks to collaborative efforts already underway on both sides of the border. And yet, TB continues to be a larger problem in the border region than in other parts of California or Mexico. Nearly a third of San Diego County TB patients have ties to Baja California, Mexico, and San Diego has a TB rate that is twice our national rate. Tuberculosis is caused by bacteria that most often attack the lungs, but can also attack other parts of the body, such as the kidney, the spine, or even the brain. If not treated properly, TB can be fatal and continue to spread to others. Health officials from San Diego County, Imperial County, and Mexico were on hand for the Transborder Agreement signing ceremony, which also includes two nonprofit organizations. The multi-jurisdictional strategy to fight tuberculosis was established with a grant that the International Community Foundation received from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The overall goal is to find more ways to identify and treat tuberculosis patients, especially those with drug-resistant strains of the disease, working to improve public health across our region.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
A new study says California could save $250 million a year in healthcare costs and improve the lives of millions of children by eliminating exposure to preventable environmental hazards such as lead, pesticides, secondhand smoke, car exhaust, and certain household chemicals. The report is from the nonprofit Public Health Institute's California Environmental Health Tracking Program. Galatea King, one of the report's authors, says they focused on multiple conditions, including asthma, leukemia, autism, and ADHD.
We looked at estimates of what amount of the burden of each condition could be attributable to the environment. We were looking at things that could be prevented.
For example, California could fund more programs to remove toxic lead paint or build more clean, affordable housing to cut down on asthma. King says efforts to combat climate change are also key.
the worsening environmental impact of climate change is going to really affect children's health, such as air pollution and dust and pollen in the air, water contamination, and potential use for more pesticides as our climate changes.
The researchers hope policymakers will use the data to justify more environmental efforts. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Joanne Armstrong with a warning from the San Diego Sheriff about scammers targeting the elderly in our region. Recently, an elderly man reported receiving a telephone call from a suspect claiming to be a representative of the criminal courts. The suspect told the victim he owed money for traffic tickets and demanded payment or the victim would be arrested. This type of telephone scam is commonly used to steal from the elderly and is a reoccurring problem, the sheriff's office warns. Seniors are advised to be wary of anyone trying to collect money over the telephone. Seniors should write down the phone number, name of the person calling, and report the activity to law enforcement. If you have any questions about financial elder abuse, please contact your local agency or the San Diego County Sheriff's Elder Abuse Unit at 858-974-2322.
Activists are protesting tax breaks for the $3 billion private prison industry, which runs 16 facilities in California. They protested at an industry conference in New York last week about a loophole that lets private prison companies claim to be in the real estate business and thus pay less income tax. Ian Truppen with the Responsible Endowments Coalition says California is at the forefront of the move toward private prisons.
After the federal government, California is the largest customer of the private prison industry in the United States.
In 2013, a federal judge ordered California to fix overcrowding in its prisons, which led to the practice of sending prisoners to private facilities. The Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group, the two biggest private prison firms, say they're providing a public service. Opponents like Truppen say the firms make financial donations to lawmakers who support anti-crime laws, laws that swell the prison ranks.
We need to really make this issue something toxic for politicians, that they have to stop taking money from private prisons and stop passing the laws that this lobby is really going for.
Activists are currently running campaigns to press the University of California system and the County of Los Angeles to divest their holdings in private prison companies. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Tony Tiora. Tony is a Julian resident, and he's lived in East County since 2008. He ran for the Assembly against Brian Jones the last time around when Assemblyman Jones was an incumbent.
Both are Republicans, but with very different views. This is a conservative district where last time around the Democrats did not run a candidate other than a write-in candidate. They didn't have one on the ballot.
And I understand, Tony, that you have a very special announcement for us today.
Well, yes, I do, Miriam, and I want to thank you again for having me on your show. I will be running for state assembly again in 2016, and this time around, I'm going to spend quite a bit more time campaigning. I had a little son last time, right during the campaign.
That's
in
right,
September.
Brand new baby in the family.
Yeah, so it was a tough race because Brian, you know, is an incumbent, and I didn't take any special interest money or corporate money in that race.
Yeah, there you go. Well, this time I understand it's going to be a little different. It's an open seat, and there are at least three Republicans who've announced plans to run. Mike Harrison, who is Congressman Hunter's aide, Santee Mayor, Randy Bopel, and then they are both positioned as conservatives. And Tony, I understand that you're a little bit of a maverick in the race in that you hold some conservative views, and on some other issues, you hold some moderate to libertarian-leaning views.
That's absolutely correct, Miriam. You know, I grew up in New Jersey. And I was involved in the New Jersey Conservative Party with Tom Blomquist. We were a party that was growing, and we were actually the largest, I think, third party in New Jersey at the time. But I moved from New Jersey and I lived in Japan for about 10 years and I came to California in 2004. You know, as you get older, you know, you change on things and you realize that some things make sense and some things don't make sense. And for me, you know, I've stayed as a fiscal conservative, but on issues like certain social issues, even though like I consider myself religiously conservative, I don't think, you know, things like pro-choice and pro-life. I'm a pro-choice person politically, even though I'm pro-life personally. So, you know, I don't think that that's a very libertarian view to be pushing people, you know, on certain social issues. Fiscally, you know, I think that the government, you know, even a lot of people say they're conservatives, but they're really not. They love spending, but just certain spending in their areas. You know, as being a maverick, what I don't want is, I think we have politicians nowadays that are controlled by special interests and money. And that's why you see the things that they do, whether it be on something like a tobacco issue or special interest. You're like, why would they build something in this area that doesn't make sense? Or why are they voting this way? Some certain things you look at and you say they don't make sense. It's based upon special interest money, in my opinion.
Climate change is one issue where there seems to be some differentiation. Both Brian Jones, the incumbent, and certainly Mayor Vopel have both been very vocal climate change deniers. Tell me your views on that.
I think that's crazy. I can't see how anybody who looks at the facts and the information can deny that there's climate change, let alone, I mean, that there's global warming. It's basically a scientific number. You can look at a map and say, are temperatures rising or temperatures decreasing? You know, something like 99% of the scientists that look at the weather will tell you that, you know, we have a problem. I mean, you don't even need to be like a scientist. I mean, we have a drought in California.
Yeah.
I mean, we're running out of water. I mean,
major wildfires.
These people are doing a disservice to their constituents by proposing that there is no climate change or no global warming.
Okay. Now, this would be a good time to give our listeners a little bit of background about you, Tony. I understand that you're an electrical engineer. You have a degree in electrical engineering, and you also did some studies at Harvard Business School. You spent time in Japan, where you started up an ISP and a software company. You're currently a data solutions manager for a major bank, and you're a science fiction novelist with several novels published.
I know. It sounds kind of crazy, right? What kind of resume is that for a politician?
Well, you know, there's things in Sacramento can be difficult to believe sometimes. They stretch credibility. So maybe a science fiction background might be good preparation for that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about why you decided to run for office. You've talked about a responsibility to society.
Well, I think, you know, I've said this to other folks, and I think I've mentioned this to you, that, you know, we get the government that we deserve, right? So if you sit at home and all you're doing is watching, flicking through the channels and eating popcorn and not getting involved and you're complaining like why you have like somebody building, you know, a wind farm in your backyard that you don't like, or they're digging holes for some kind of tunnel, or they're polluting your water, you have a responsibility to do something. And you know, I mentioned earlier that my wife and I recently had a son last year. I've been feeling recently, you know, as I've been looking at what's going on in California, that more and more we need to take control of what's happening here in this state.
Yeah.
And for me, I've been involved in politics off and on, usually from the sidelines. You know, I was involved in New Jersey with some tax organizations trying to cut our taxes. But I see some major issues in California, and I felt that with my background that I could actually do something.
Give us an example or two of a couple of the major issues you would want to address if you win your election, Tony.
Well, for example, the big thing a lot of people talk about is the economy, because, you know, people are going broke and they don't know why. And they say, well, you know, the stock market's going up. We have the highest stock prices in history, but why am I running out of money?
Yeah, and yet we have 29% poverty rate in Oklahoma, even higher in many of the rural areas, 60% unemployment rate among some of the Iraqi Chaldeans in East County. So poverty and joblessness and simply low-wage jobs, as opposed to, say, high-income or moderate-income manufacturing jobs, is a huge problem in this district that I think hasn't really been addressed very much by some of the recent representatives. Well, you know, what would you do differently?
A couple things. For example, you know, businesses, at the bottom line, it's about making a profit. So you can't expect a company to say, you know, we have to go help everybody who's poor. That's not what the executives of those firms do. You know, they're looking at making a profit. So we have to give them incentives to come into the district to increase the job growth. For example, I like the idea of tax abatements. I think it'd be great that, you know, for farms and things like that in those areas that you allow companies to come in and say, look, you're not going to have property taxes for 10 years, mm-hmm. or you're not going to have to pay the same state income taxes or even the employee taxes.
Yeah.
We need to make it and give them incentives to be here and create jobs.
San Diego has more family farms of 10 acres or less than any county in America, and a lot of them are struggling right now. Not so much the economy, but the drought right now is also taking a big toll. And we're seeing the county supervisors making some efforts to encourage more agritourism. I'm not sure if that's really the best word, but for example, simply loosening up the regulations so that if a winery wants to build a bed and breakfast or they want to offer, you know, a little bit of live music, some guy with an acoustic guitar singing on the weekends to draw people in, they could do that. Or you could have cheese making or beekeeping,
sure,
a little bit easier.
Sure.
Do we need more easing of regulations to encourage these, you know, family farmers to be able to have more ways to earn a living than just using a lot of water?
That's a trick question, Mary. Of course. I mean, who wants more regulations? Yeah. Do you want the sheriff coming in because somebody's got a little guitar player playing some music to a few tours?
Which is going on.
You know, no.
With no complaints.
No, you want to reduce regulations that will increase tourism. Definitely. Without a question.
I would like to talk about energy issues. You mentioned about projects going in that communities don't want. And we're seeing this more than ever before in East County in particular, because this is where the land is. We've seen wind projects with 500-foot tall wind turbines being approved in communities where it was zoned, you know, one house for 80
right,
acres. And
right.
They consider this not an industrial use. 500 feet, that's taller than the highest skyscraper, you know, in downtown San Diego. We see sand mining being proposed in El Monte Valley and Lakeside to tear up a beautiful valley, you know, that has valley fever spores that would be spread around 150 trucks a day going down these roads. And yet over and over, what we see is these kind of projects, the local planning group typically votes against it. The citizens are all up in arms opposed to it. And yet it gets down to the supervisors. And very often it gets approved, maybe not with Supervisor Jacob, but the other four that don't live here vote these in over and over and over and over again. Is there a role here for the state to step in on these kinds of things?
Well, you know, I'm going to give you a little bit of a truthful joke here, but someone said we had horrible politicians, and somebody once said to me, no, Tony, we actually have the best politicians that money can buy. And that's what we actually have. You know, not all, but we have, you know, special interests and corporate money that are funding these initiatives. And it's basically so the corporations get money and they'll have the politicians, you know, that'll just twist their arm and say, vote this way.
Taking away local control.
And we need lots of people actually in a state legislature that, you know, is not going to be strong armed, who's actually going to take a stand that's for the people in their community to say, look, why should somebody 100 miles away be telling me, you know, what I should have in my backyard? I always believe that, like, the government closest to the people best represents the people,
mm-hmm.
and therefore those locals should have a veto over some state, you know, board trying to force, you know, a wind farm, an oil factory, whatever it is. If the local folks don't want it, now don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, business is important. We need oil. We need electricity. You know, but we got
to
do it smart.
Maybe to incentivize if they really want that, to offer something to the community in
sure.
exchange. And I've heard you mention that you think we need something like a restore local control bill to help sort of rein in this kind of stuff.
Totally. I would support legislation for a restore local control bill in the legislature. I think that there would be widespread support for that, because the last thing people want in my district is like some bureaucrat out of Sacramento yeah. forcing something in their backyards that they don't want. So I think that like the local board should be able to veto if they've decided that they don't want something in their backyard. I think their decision should be final.
So the community planning groups should not be merely advisory. You think that should be a final decision that supervisors can't overrule, or the state legislature for that matter?
No, they can't. But you could always, like, if the people don't like the decisions, they can always remove those folks.
That's true. That's right? true. Or the state or the county right. can come back and offer a few more incentives to try to get it through rather than just making decisions.
We're destroying our environment. We yeah. can't, this is not sustainable. And so, like, when they talk about these wind farms and these power plants, you know, whether they're solar farms, you know, hundreds of miles away, I prefer more of a local, like, I would love to see more local solar projects and things of that nature rather than doing things hundreds and hundreds of miles away.
Yeah, there you go.
Solar on roofs and parking lots instead of meadows and deserts.
A few more issues we should speak about. You have mentioned that vaccines is something that you have an opinion on that you'd like to tell our listeners about.
Well, yeah. You know, I was looking at the legislation. I think it's SB 277 that some pediatrician put through the Senate, and it's been approved. As a libertarian, I don't like government getting involved in what medicines, you know, I take. I understand that, you know, vaccines seem to be a little bit different because, you know, you don't want – I mean, we had polio and things like that, and I know that vaccines have helped, you know, remove a lot of these major diseases. But I think that it's horrible to have laws where the government is going to mandate, you know, how many vaccines my kid's going to get. I mean, if I decide I want the measles and a few shots, that's fine. But I don't think that I should be forced into every shot that the CDC puts out, that some government bureaucrat, you know, vaccines used to be something of a civic responsibility. It wasn't really big money years mm-hmm. ago, and you only had maybe 5 or 8 vaccines. Now, you know, it's big business. It's a $1 billion business. I would argue that people like working at the CDC are really puppets to the big farm industry. And you got to be really careful because they could be putting out vaccine. You know, they're putting out vaccines to kids now. As soon as they're born, they're trying to shoot them up with a vaccine. And the baby's growing. And there's been some studies that, you know, you should wait. And I like the idea of keeping the religious exemption. I think those of religion who don't believe in it, you know, you shouldn't be forcing them to get the vaccines. And I think the personal exemption to take away is horrible. You know, there are people, it's not a lot of news on this because 70% of advertising now on television is like from the big pharma.
Yeah.
There's people like Robert Kennedy Jr. who are out there, you know, talking about some of the issues with vaccines. You probably don't hear much of it on television because
I do. He's an opponent of mandatory vaccines. And then on the other side of the issue, there's been a multi-center study recently that said that they don't cause autism. I know there were earlier studies that said that they did. So,
well, I would argue on the autism, I would like to make a point on that. And there's another study, you know, there was a guy by the name of Dr. William Thompson who worked for the CDC, and he came out with a report in 2004 in a pediatric journal that he was pushed to withdraw data and information that showed that African American kids got something like a 236% increase in autism from the MMR. Other races, you know, had an increase, but not as high as that. And he's a whistleblower right now. So I'm not anti-vaccine. I think we need vaccines. I just think we need to limit them and the parents to choose. I just don't want government telling me what vaccines I can or can't take. And I don't think the government should be telling people of religion who don't believe in them that they have to take them.
Is there a middle ground here? For example, when we had the outbreak of measles in Los Angeles, what we saw was a couple of the public schools up there were telling parents of children who had not been vaccinated that you need to keep your child home for 2 weeks because we don't want them to catch the measles and continue spreading this throughout the school. It's fine if you chose not to have it, but when there's an outbreak,
yeah,
you know.
I have no problem with that. I mean, they're making a smart decision. They, you know, but the thing is, people should also be aware that just because you got a measles vaccine, it's not 100% effective. You know, it's only like maybe 80%,
95% for measles. Others is less. But
yeah.
Yes. Whooping cough is a lot lower right now.
Yeah. Maybe it is. But so those vaccines, like a lot of them are like 80, 90, as you said. Does that mean that those kids are safe? They're not 100% safe either.
Yeah, that's true. Another issue is smoking. Now, this is interesting because there is a vote that was taken we just covered this at the El Cajon Council hearing where the council majority voted to send a letter to Brian Jones, their assemblyman, asking him to vote for Senate Bill 151, which would raise the smoking age to 21 years of age in California, just as the drinking age already is. I understand that Assemblyman Jones has taken some tobacco money. Our state senator, Joel Anderson, took a lot of tobacco money and voted no on that. So I'd like to ask you, Tony, where do you stand on that bill? Do you think that smoking should or should not be allowed for people under 21 years of age in California?
Well, you know, the libertarian side of me says that, you know, it's a personal decision to smoke or not smoke, and that the government should stay completely out of it. But, you know, the moderate side of me, you know, as I've gotten older and looked at this issue, tells me that tobacco industry spends billions of dollars a year trying to brainwash folks into smoking. Smoking kills something like 6 million people a year, about 480 or 500,000 or so people in the United States a year. And I think it's a tragedy. I think it's a healthcare crisis. I mean, you know, if you could find anything, you say, wow, there's a disease and we can stop it. It's 500,000 people a year. I mean, that's big. I think that increasing the age to 21 is fine, and I would completely support it. I have not taken money from tobacco industries, and I don't ever plan on taking any. I think that those voting decisions, like I said earlier, you know, they're going to send him a letter. But, you know, tobacco industries have done something more than sending Brian Jones a letter. They've sent him some money.
Yeah. So I seriously we'll doubt. We'll see whether he stands up to that or not.
I seriously doubt he's going to change his stance.
There you go. Yeah, and Councilman Kendrick gave the statistic that 1 in 3 customers who start smoking, cigarette industry kills 1 out of every 3 of its customers.
I've heard it was up to 50%, but, You know, but just because something kills you doesn't mean that we should legislate. Like, for example, you know, red meat can kill you from eating too much. I mean, the Coca-Colas, the large sodas, you know, aren't healthy, but I don't think we should be legislating the size of sodas or how much meat we eat.
So you're not into the nanny state except in these extreme cases.
And it hurts me to get involved in this type of issue. I think people should be free to choose, you know, but I think this one is special in the sense that it's so pervasive and it's so dangerous.
Now, an issue that you swing more to the conservative side of the aisle, I understand, is gun rights or gun control, depending on the terminology one wants to use. But can you tell us your views on guns?
Well, I mean, I believe in the United States Constitution. I believe in the right to bear arms. I'm a National Rifle Association, you know, member. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there are some people who would argue, well, we have too many laws in California. We need to change them. I like the waiting period on guns and stuff like that. Even though I don't like the idea, you know, of having any infringement upon, you know, right to bear arms, I think in a civilized society, things like a waiting list, as long as it's not, you know, crazy, that it's something that the benefits outweigh the risks.
Yeah, so making sure that, say, somebody who's mentally ill, like the Colorado shooter, can't go in and buy a gun and shoot up a theater.
Right, but the thing is, you know, a lot of these people always bring up these shooting cases. A lot of times these people don't have, you know, it wasn't their gun. They stole somebody else's gun, and they probably would have stolen a knife or something, you know, else to kill somebody. I think they were just nuts in general. But so I support gun rights, but I also support, you know, a reasonable, you know, the laws we have now that, you know, you have to, there's a certain cooling off period before you get your gun.
You mentioned health care earlier. We've seen a lot of controversy around Obamacare. On the one hand, certainly there's 40 million Americans who now have health care coverage who didn't have it before. On the other hand, it is mandatory to buy it, and many people, particularly in the middle class, have actually found that promise about if you like your health care, you can keep it didn't quite happen. Some of the insurance companies left the state, and rates have gone up for many people in the middle class, to name just two of the key issues about it. I'm curious where you stand on health care.
That's a real tough issue because, you see, I don't like the government telling me that I have to buy anything. From my libertarian views, I just don't think government should be telling me that I gotta buy car insurance. I don't have to have a car. I happen to have a body, so I can understand that, you know, that people would like to force me to have health insurance. So I didn't like it. I know it got upheld in the court, so that's a moot subject at this point.
Yeah, and I should throw out here, I'd love to focus this question not so much on the national issue, because you're not running for Congress and have no control over what's going to happen at the federal government, where there's a very divisive Congress.
Right.
But we are in California, where a couple of years ago, actually, the legislature came very close to passing a universal health care bill for all. It would have been, you know, far more expansive than anything Obamacare did. So the political climate is very different in California. I'm curious, if you get elected, what would you like to try to do to change or improve the health care laws, specifically in the state of California, that might actually be perhaps doable?
Right. And that's a tricky question, because people think that something's doable, and then they find that their premiums get higher.
Exactly.
They find that they lose their insurer that they're promised to keep.
You know, like the Republicans, pretty much most of them, the official party line seems to be that Obamacare, bad.
No,
it should be repealed, but they don't really have a plan to replace it.
I wouldn't throw the baby in the bathwater out. We have a big problem here with healthcare. And, many people go bankrupt because of healthcare costs. You know, they get a major injury and they go bankrupt.
Actually, Congress recently passed a law that went through that you can no longer discharge your medical bills through bankruptcy. Can you believe that one? So now, you can have $10 million in because of your open heart surgery or something when you're poor, and it will follow you the rest of your life now.
That's crazy. I think I should be running for Congress next, but you don't want to hear that. What I would do is look at what is working and what is not working. Because now we have some hindsight with Obamacare. We can see what's working and we can see what's not working. And I would definitely, take a look at producing something for the state. Because I always as I said earlier, the government closest to people best represents the people. Mm-hmm. Having Washington make these healthcare laws, I would prefer to rescind them and have something just for the state that works for the state. Mm-hmm. But we can't, we can't be this nanny state either, because this is all going to cost money. So we have to look at things. How do we give incentives to doctors, like it's supply and demand? If we could get more doctors, if I could give, in this state, if we had laws that reduced the tax rates for doctors to live here, maybe, schooling for doctors, reduce the rates for people going to school for medicine, because they end up leaving school with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt that they have to pay off, so they have to charge lots of money.
True.
Maybe things with clinics, you can maybe have people who don't have necessarily a doctor's degree, but's capable of, doing certain medical procedures to reduce the cost. We have to look at what works, doesn't work, and be really smart. There is no free lunch. A lot of people think that, we'll make it free. Even in Japan, for example, where I lived, they have national health care. It worked real well. But guess what? You weren't forced into paying for it.
Yeah.
But if you went to a doctor and you didn't have it, they wouldn't treat you. We're here in the United States, and you can just go into an emergency room and get treated. So we have a very different system here. We have to think about
Interesting.
It. Interesting. Yeah.
What did you think about the Japanese system overall? Do you think that's something that should be looked at here?
Totally. I was fascinated at how well that system worked. It wasn't that expensive. It was national single payer health care. Mm-hmm. So, as a libertarian, it was like, government, health care, blah, blah.
Yeah, big government, big brother.
Right, big brother. But I was amazed. But they have a different system there. Like I said, the doctors, probably don't get paid as much as they do here. Mm-hmm. They don't have the pervasiveness of the health insurance industry that we have to deal with here that runs the show. So, you have to work within the variables and constrictions you have here. It's a different beast here and very complicated, but we need to fix it because it's so important. So I wish I had an answer, Miriam. I really don't. I would look at what works and what doesn't work and try to do something local.
If you were to get elected, are there any specific committees that you would hope to serve on?
The sad thing is I don't know how many committees we got. imagine there's probably 1,000 committees, in the assembly.
But key
topics for me would be things like, any committee that is related to energy. I'd be very interested in being on energy committees. My engineering background, I think, would help with something like that. I would be interested on committees because of the vaccine thing that I talked about. I'd be interested in being on a committee related to the health, of our state, whether it be health insurance or, those types of laws that just passed with SB 277. I would also be interested I'm really interested in the economy. So anything that I could do related to reducing taxes for the district, for the farmers, and encouraging businesses to come to the district. And it doesn't even have to be for the district. I think we could do things that, that make California, that could attract business away from places like Texas that are stealing our business and bring it back to California.
There you go. Tony, I'm going to give you the last word here. Do you have some final thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with today on KNSJ?
If you're a listener, and obviously the listeners here are in my district, my name's Tony Tior. I'm a candidate for state assembly. If you want somebody who is not going to be bought up by the special interests and is really going to fight for you, vote for me in the upcoming election and support my candidacy. You can go to my website, www.tonytior.org, and see my positions.
And that's spelled T-E-O-R-A.
That's correct, Mira.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. And I'd like to add that we will be reaching out, and we certainly extend an invitation to all of the candidates in this race to come on our show on KNSJ and share your views with our listeners, too. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery. This week, we're on the road in Hukumba Hot Springs, a town that is bubbling with activity. The town recently changed its name to take back its historic roots. The name Hukumba means healing waters and traces its roots back to the Kumeyaay Native American people who used to spend their winters by these natural hot springs. By the 1920s, Hukumba had become a mecca for Hollywood celebrities in the silent movie era. But then a fire burned down the historic hotel and bathhouse, and construction of Interstate 8 moved traffic away from old Highway 80 through the heart of this community. Hukumba almost became a ghost town, but now it is springing back to life thanks to the vision of the people here with us today. Dave Landman is a successful businessman who was actually asked by the townspeople to buy a rundown spa and resort and turn it once again into a destination to draw people to Hukumba Hot Springs. So he bought the promissory note for the Hukumba Hot Springs Resort, and he made a surprising discovery. Dave, tell us what else was in that note.
Well, it turns out that the promissory note was secured by 29 properties throughout the town. It included most of the downtown area, some residential sites, and a lot of vacant land.
So what was your reaction when you learned that you were the proud new owner of an entire town?
Well, it went from one project to 29 projects, so it was a little bit overwhelming at the time.
Now, the people of the town were confident that Dave could make this a success because he already owns another wildly successful business in Hukumba. Tell us about that, Dave.
Yeah, about 15 years ago, my wife and I bought a rundown RV park on the north side of Interstate 8, and we actually turned it into the eighth largest clothing optional resort in the United States, the Anza Springs Resort.
So what is so attractive about Hukumba to bring so many people there?
It's a number of things. Number one, it's just an hour away from San Diego, so you know, we call that the daycation destination place where people can come out for the weekend or just for the day use and enjoy the facilities. There's also the climate is beautiful because we're above the clouds, and in the summertime especially, we're so much cooler than the valley, so we get a lot of people up there from the El Centro, Yuma, Palm Springs area.
Now, Dave has been hard at work remodeling the Hukumba Hot Springs Resort, adding a new restaurant and a Southwest decor. But there won't be any skinny dipping since the spa will not be clothing optional. Now, Dave, what else are you planning in the area?
Nothing is finalized yet, but we've had a number of calls from people interested in renting some of the retail spaces. We've had some artists contact us because they know our desire to turn it into an art-type community. We're working on a number of things. You know, some of the things in the back of my head are maybe a winery. We've talked about a number of other things, but that one kind of comes to the head all the time.
Thank you very much, Dave. Danielle Cook is a driving force behind the Hukumba Boulevard Revitalization Alliance. In fact, she and her husband, Howard, helped recruit Dave to buy the Hot Springs Resort. Danielle, tell us about your vision for Hukumba Hot Springs.
My vision of Hukumba Hot Springs is similar to that of the Landmans. I envision the community as being another backcountry version, if you will, of Taos, New Mexico, a community where artists gather, where entrepreneurs want to come in and build businesses, where people want to come and chill out at the Hot Springs Spa and enjoy our special air, light, and ambiance.
You've started some websites where people can find out more about the hidden treasures in Hukumba Hot Springs and the surrounding areas.
Yes, we started a website about a year ago, www.gosandiegobackcountry.org, to give tourists an idea of some of the free things that they could do in the backcountry, in Boulevard and Hukumba, and also places where they could stay, places where they could eat. We even have a section that tells people of different hikes they can go on and gives them an idea of a road trip that they can take with their family.
And you also have another website devoted just to Hukumba, and that site is hukumba.org.
Yes.
Now, there is also a lake, Lake Hukumba,
which had gone virtually dry, and now I understand it's being restored.
Akumba Lake now is for a virtual birder's paradise. The lake is filling up naturally. We have nesting tricolors, which are a bird of special interest, according to the Audubon. We have birders there every weekend, and this has brought in business for Akumba Lounge and will bring in business for the spa. In addition, some of the residents of Akumba have taken it upon themselves to clear brush and have built trails, so you can now walk almost entirely around the lake.
Wow, that's great. Plus, as you mentioned, the Akumba Hikers and Walkers is another new group that's formed, and they're leading people on treks all over through the scenic mountains, deserts, and historic sites in this region. Akumba also has an arts council, and recently they revived another town tradition, the Akumba Blues Festival.
Enigmatic love, a love like no other. In the summer sun, I strolled the shore. The sand warmed my feet. The waves soothed my heart within a glowing light.
I'm here today with Joe Marshall, a talented blues musician who is the powerhouse behind the festival. Joe, tell me how long you've been playing the blues.
Well, I've been playing the blues for about 45 years, and I got interested in the blues. Some friends of mine started turning me on to it. At the time, I was interested in most rock and roll, I guess about anybody my age would have been. And I found that the blues suited more of my music because I primarily play the harmonica. I love the blues because it's for everybody. It's from the working man to the white collar.
This is the second annual Akumba Blues Festival. What makes this such a special event for the local musicians?
It's a great event for the local musicians. They get to network. They get to meet a lot of other musicians from all over. We had musicians from San Diego. We had musicians from Imperial Valley. We had musicians from the Midwest. We had musicians from Northern California. And so it made it very special, primarily because of that, and secondly because it gave all these people a chance to reunite.
So it's one big jam session out there.
One big family, one big jam session, yes.
We're going to end today by playing a little riff here from Mama Christie, who is one of the talented musicians that you could hear out at the Akumba Blues Festival. And you can find her music at www.mamachristie.com. This song is called Drip, and it was written after the 9/11 attacks, and it's all about the healing power of love. And here in the town of Healing Waters, Akumba Hot Springs, it seems especially fitting. You can find out more about Akumba Hot Springs at www.eastcountymagazine.org, and be sure to tune in for future editions of On the Road in East County.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Joanne Armstrong with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today I'm here with Monty Turner, a volunteer with Senior Gleaners, an organization that picks fruit and other foods and donated to local agencies that feed the hungry. Welcome to our show, Monty.
Thank you.
So my first question for you is, with the unique name Senior Gleaners, where did the term gleaning or gleaner came from?
A gleaner is somebody that comes in and picks surplus food or crops. It actually goes back to biblical times when often a ruler or a wealthy person would set aside part of their crop and then after harvest time would let the peasants or poor people come in and harvest the remainder.
Okay, tell me what exactly your organization is about.
Now, the Senior Gleaners do two things. One part of our mission is to collect surplus fruit from throughout the county. We do a lot of picking in backyard gardens, can be anywhere from a couple of trees to a dozen. And we also collect surplus food from grocery stores and food service providers. And that can be anything from bread that has expired to food that just hasn't sold and isn't going to be sold. So rather than have that go to waste, we take it and we truck it to a warehouse where our recipient agencies come on a regular basis, take it to their distribution points, and give it to their clients.
That's perfect. So how is the recipient chosen when you're distributing the food?
The people that are eligible to receive those donations must be meeting the federal poverty guideline. They receive the food at no charge. We provide it at no charge to those distributing agencies. And none of our volunteers, nor any of our board members or people that do our coordination, no one is paid on our side either. So it's a free service to people that are also in turn not charged for what they receive.
Okay. And I understand that your organization is in need of volunteers. On average, how many volunteers do you need, and what are the tasks of the volunteers?
We currently have a group of about 65 volunteers. We could use way more. Besides people to do the tasks that I mentioned of picking fruit, driving vans to then transport the fruit back to our warehouse, people to staff our warehouse to sort the food, and to be there to help load trucks when the recipients come in. We also have a need for people to help with administrative tasks, keeping track of our volunteer hours, answering the phone, coordinating where we're going to go to get the food. So a wide variety of needs.
And since homeowners are allowed to be donors, how could they benefit from donating their surplus foods or their fruits, I should say?
There are several benefits to the homeowner. Just a basic one is that we're saving them a lot of work. If they have extra fruit on trees or produce that they're not using, they don't have to pick it. They don't have to clean it up. On fruit trees, it's very beneficial to get the fruit picked off before the next crop comes on. It's more healthy for the trees. And we also give them a receipt, and they can value the amount that they've donated and use it as a tax deduction.
That's perfect for those who are trying to figure out how they continue their crops but also pay for the water bill.
Yes, one reason that we're looking for more donors is that some of our traditional donors, their crops just aren't doing as well as they have in the past because of the cost of water. So that has really increased our need for more donors to make up for the ones that aren't able to give as much as they have in the past.
And for our listeners who are interested in becoming a volunteer or a donor themselves, how could they get in contact with your organization?
They should call our coordinator, Elaine, at 619-463-6356, or they can email her at ehiel@aol.com.
And we will also post this on the East County Magazine website under our food section. Before we end, I would like to ask you, what agencies do you support?
There are a variety of agencies that we support. These range from churches to food pantries. We provide food to a teen transition home. So there's a huge variety of people that get the food. It's all over the county, and we estimate that the need is 10 times what we are currently meeting. So we have a huge need for the food and for volunteers to help us collect it.
What are some of the achievements your organization accomplished this past year?
In 2014, we were able to gather 500,000 pounds of food, and we distributed those to 45 agencies. We had 65 volunteers, and they provided 10,000 hours of volunteer work to accomplish that.
That's truly amazing. That's really good for the people. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for helping us spread the word.
Anytime.
This is Miriam Raftery with good news for camping enthusiasts out there.
The Helix Water Board, which has been considering shutting down the campground at Lake Jennings, has granted a reprieve and delayed action for a year. The vote came after the board heard impassioned testimony from the public, including a Boy Scout leader and residents who shared their own fond childhood memories of camping at the lake. But the long-term future of the campground is not yet secure, despite recent financial gains. Since Helix took back ownership of the lake in 2008, the campground had been losing money at $200,000 a year. But that deficit has dropped nearly tenfold, down to only $24,000 this year. Board members agreed to allow one more year to try and make the lake's campground break even or turn a profit, and also voted to allocate $20,000 for marketing campground activities. Some members of the public argued that a lake and a campground should not be all about money, that the public's interest should take precedence. Bob McDowell, a Boy Scout leader, pointed out that the campground costs just 12 cents a month per ratepayer to run. He said that hundreds of children want to camp at the lake. It would be a travesty to take that away from these kids, he told the board. Board President Deanna Verbecki said that to her, it's all about dollars and cents. Then she disclosed that Supervisor Diane Jacob has sent a letter stating she will ask the county's Parks and Recreation Department to look at a potential partnership role with the county and Helix to keep the campground open. Director Kathleen Coates-Hedberg noted that a recent increase in efforts by the board to get publicity out has increased attendance at the campground, a trend she hopes will continue. But Director John Linden had a different view. He insisted that the district's obligation is only to its ratepayers, noting that most of the lake's users live outside the Helix District. He also said a consultant concluded that the campground needs millions of dollars in upgrades. He concluded, "We're not in the entertainment business. We're not in the camping business." He ultimately did vote to support Verbecki's one-year delay on closing the campground, but said he would support keeping it open long-term only if other cities or the county will agree to invest in the cost-sharing. Director Chuck Muse also voiced concerns, but in the end also backed the motion, at least for now. Just 1 year earlier, the board had considered closing the entire lake to the public, but has since been able to make all other sectors profitable except the campground, and that may soon be in the black, too. After the hearing, Director Joel Scalziti, who headed up the committee to save the lake and its campground, told East County Magazine he is very pleased with the vote, particularly the $20,000 allocated for marketing activities for the first time. Strides are being made, such as getting state approval for kayaks on the lake just last month, he disclosed, adding that already a kayaking club has shown interest in holding group activities at the lake's campground. Scalziti voiced confidence that the new marketing dollars will enable profitability to be achieved in the near future and save one of East County's treasures.
This is Carrie Hyatt reporting for the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Summertime is here, and the county's Department of Animal Services wants to remind everyone that these hot days can pose a danger to your pets. Animals can be very sensitive to high heat. Here are some tips to keep your pet safe and comfortable during hot weather. Be sure your pet has shade all day. Remember, the sun's position changes during the day. Keep your pets indoors if the temperature is lower inside. Keep your pet's water supply always topped off, and be sure it is cool. Pets will not drink water that is too hot. Consider a misting system to keep the outdoor areas cooler. A car can heat up very quickly on an 85-degree day. A car can reach 102 degrees in 10 minutes and soar upward to 120 degrees, even with the windows down an inch or two. So never leave your pet unattended in the car. If you exercise with your dog, do so only in the very early morning when the temperature is lower. Don't take dogs on extreme hikes in the heat, since many dogs have perished in hot weather on local trails. Don't take your dogs for walks on the hot pavement. If it is too hot for you to walk barefoot, then don't make your dogs do it either, since this can burn the pads of their feet. Consider adding a child's wading pool for your dog. Many dogs will keep cool by taking a dip. Following these tips can keep your pet safe and healthy during hot weather.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.